little different with the microphone here. Let's see if I can get. There we go. All right, so where do we start? What happened? What it was like? What's like now? All right, so my home group is the 2020 Vision for You Tuesday night. We'd love to see you. Big book meeting. We're going through the book now. It's 7 o'clock on Tuesdays. Myself, Shay, Veronica's here. A couple other people might jump in and out. So if you ever want to get on it, let us know. We'd love to have you. It saved my life, the big book. And I'm a proponent of it, although I always was a proponent of it. So I grew up in Northeast Philadelphia and at Grantner Boulevard to just a normal Irish Catholic alcoholic home, I think. Like, I don't know what's unnormal, so that's pretty normal to me. And I grew up right after there was an explosion of kids probably 5 to 10 years before me. And so I lived a block away from the schoolyard. And it was just like kids were everywhere. And I would actually, and I remember at a really early age, like since 3 or 4, like I can remember I had like this crazy fear in me. And I would be afraid just to walk to the schoolyard because I had to always, it was almost like I was getting beat up all the time by all the kids. So at a really young age, I had this kind of fear that was already in me that, that I learned later was self-centered fear driven by a bunch of different things. But so at an early age, I had this feeling of fear and nothing happened. Like I didn't have any crazy childhood. Like I wasn't abused. My dad wasn't around. He was in his active addiction and my mom was 17 when she had me. So she was around, but she wasn't really working a lot. So I stayed with my grandma and there were 4 other people in the family. And so there was a lot of drinking, a lot of smoking cigarettes, a lot of smoking pot, not necessarily in the house, but there was everyone doing stuff at the corners. And I just kind of grew up in an environment where, everyone drank, you know, and at the early age, I can remember if you're like me, I looked up to those dudes like they were God. You know what I mean? Like I wanted to be just like Ronnie DeMeo. I wanted to be just like Kevin Casey, just like you. I wound up being like Huey, who's my uncle. I wound up being exactly like him, actually. Which is kind of like a, you know, self-prophecy type thing. But anyway, so I grew up in Northeast Philly. I played all sports. I was good at sports. I was never the last one for kickball, so I didn't have that type of a thing happen. Although the feeling inside of me was like that. Right? So at a really early age, I had this feeling of separation. So if you ever hear anyone talk about, because I didn't understand this for a long time, what a sense of separation is. A sense of separation is like I had a wedding that I went to like a month and a half ago, right? And in the reception, everyone's drinking. And I walk in, and when I walk in, I completely feel different than everyone else in the entire reception. Like I actually kind of feel like I'm the weirdo, right? And that's the sense of separation that people are talking about when they're talking in spiritual terms. And I had that at a really early age. Played sports, kind of like hit it a lot, was a pretty good actor. My dad was never around. And at some point, at 10 years old or 11, my mom moved to South Jersey from Northeast Philly. And that was like an entirely different world. It was like taking somebody out of taking somebody out of a city and putting in Pennsville, New Jersey in the middle of nowhere. And so not only did I feel kind of weird already, like I felt really weird, like because there's cows and there's farms or shit and stuff like that. And I was like, what am I doing here? Like the first 3 months I ran away. I got on my bike and I started to ride my bike back to Philly. that's like how like screwed up I felt there. I felt less screwed up in Philly because I had family and friends and so forth. And so if you kind of go through that, at some point there's something in you that needs to get out of it, right? Like if you're living at any age in a lot of fear, and by the way, when we live in a lot of fear, everything's a threat. Right. So if I live in a lot of fear, everything is a threat. And when I get in a fear-based mood, everything becomes a threat. And then I start to rely on my thinking. And I start to try to figure out what I'm going to do to reduce the threat, either to get you on my side or to flee, whatever you want to call that. So anyway, at the age of 11, I took my first drink and it was like magic. It was like this was the way life was supposed to be. We talk about in the book about untreated alcoholism. We talk, you hear it in circles, and I kind of refer that to page 52, the bedevilments. And so I know that I was an untreated alcoholism for my first 11 years of my life, because when I took my first drink, that stuff went away, and I became whole. I mean, it literally made me whole. It was like somebody plugged the light into life, and it was like, oh, this is what it's supposed to be like, you know? And since that time, 11 years old, ever since then, I either ran to the drink or later on I ran away from the drink, right? My entire life has revolved around running to or running from a drink. 11 years up until 45. I didn't know that that's what it was revolving around, but that's kind of what was happening. So at an early age, so that was a deal. So the first time I drank, I got drunk. I went into a blackout. And I drank to blackout. Like I drank, that was the purpose of my drinking at that age, was to get as drunk as I possibly could. I didn't care about blacking out, not blacking out. It was just a matter of just drinking as much as I possibly could. So I started stealing. I started breaking into houses. I started stealing my mom's money. I started stealing. If I went to your house, my mom took me over to friends' houses. Like they would go out back and I would be under tours. I'd be stealing liquor. I'd be taking it anywhere I could, you know? And so my life kind of revolved around that. And you take that into high school, take it into junior high, the same thing. I did a lot of drugs. And I was always getting in trouble, but not enough trouble. Like I was kind of like, I would get picked up and he would take me home and he would like, my mom would like yell at me and I'd get punished for a weekend or something. I never got like in real trouble, even though I was doing things that could definitely have gotten me locked up for a long time. So I took that same exact lifestyle in high school. And nothing really changed. 4 years of high school or 4 years of high school, by the second year, I was pretty much, when you're that young, you don't have money all the time, so you can't drink all the time, but I drank it every single chance that I got. Every single chance. I was stealing liquor. We were going to somebody's house. We were stealing their parents' liquor. We were selling something. We were doing whatever we could to get alcohol, and other things as well. And then at 16, I got in a fight with a police officer, and that was when I was put in my first rehab, and that was, Fairmont Institute, which was a dual diagnosis, and I was on the adolescent unit, and it was a lockdown unit. And I was kicked out of that, within like 10 days, right? So I had the alcoholism part happening on the outside. And then when you took alcohol away from me, I was combative and like this whole like inside of me that was kind of crazy started to come out, right? And so I was kicked out of that within 10 days. 2.5 months later, I was back in it for my second stint in rehab. I think I just turned, 17. And I really I knew I had a drinking problem. I knew there was a problem with drinking. I thought that I was probably an alcoholic, because I had seen a lot of alcoholism in my family. So I had the conception of alcoholism. I just didn't really know what an alcoholic was. I didn't really find out that until recently, over the past 5 years. But when I thought that it was just about going to meetings, just getting away from the alcohol if I could. Right. And so when I got out of rehab, that's what I did. I went to a ton of meetings. Back then, this is 1987, so there weren't a lot of young people around. There were a couple, and we hooked up and we got in trouble together. But we did. I remember one. No, that doesn't even matter. I mean, that's true. But me and the, because when you're that young, you kind of go in and out. Like you're 16, 17 years old. At least that was my story. So I was in and out of sobriety. I think at one point when I was 17, I may have had 10 months, 9 or 10 months, and I went up drinking again, and that was a year. And I just had this cycle over a couple of years of where I would get sober, I would go to meetings, it kind of wouldn't work for me, something else would be going on inside of me, then I would go out, I would drink again, then something bad would happen, and I'd go back to the meetings, and I just was like in that kind of a cycle until when I was 24, and I didn't really have anything. Like I could never get a car. I could never like save enough money to get a car. You know what I mean? Like I spent all my money on alcohol, and then if I have alcohol in me, that's one. 1A is cocaine. So if I had alcohol in me, I was getting cocaine, right? Not that I know this is an AA meeting, but that was my second thing. And I never even scratched together two nickels to get a car. Like when I got paid for whatever job I was doing, the entire paycheck was always gone by Saturday night. Luckily, maybe Sunday morning, but it was Saturday night. Usually it was completely gone. And I lived that way off and on for that period of time. And then when I was 24, I was living in Delaware at the time, and I was going back out with my high school sweetheart, and she was ready to jet, and I made the decision to get sober. Like I was done. Like I really didn't want to live like that anymore, and I was madly in love with her, and I wanted to, I wanted to have this kind of life with her, and I stopped. I went back to AA. I made that decision. I went back to AA, and I wound up staying sober for the next 11 years. Now, during that time period, if you looked at my life during that time period, and you were outside of Patrick, you would say, or you would think, or it would look like that I had my stuff together, right? It looked like that, like everything that you learn as a kid, like get, find somebody, get married, get a good job. Like I didn't graduate high school. I was kicked out a couple times, and I didn't even know if I had a high school diploma, but I worked with Mayflower, and I was contracted into this bank called MBNA, and they wound up hiring me. They wound up liking me. And so, like, I got into collections, and I wound up working my way through the business, not having a degree and not even knowing if I had a high school diploma. And through that period, like, that's what I did. Like, I was, like, making life. Like, it was working. You know what I mean? Like, her and I were getting along. We were together and we had an apartment. You know what I mean? And then we bought a little house. And I had a bad car, and I had a better car, and I had a little better car. You know, like that type of a thing was, and we didn't have any money in the bank, and we had a little bit of money in the bank. And so everyone on the outside was thinking that we were doing good. But I wasn't. Like, I was dying. I was absolutely dying inside. I didn't know I was dying inside because, again, I lived this way since I was a little kid, and I was used to living in that way. I mean, I was addicted to golf. Like, I was, like, seriously, seriously addicted to golf. I was probably borderline addicted to porn. I was probably, in my mind, would never, ever shut down at nighttime. When I tried to sleep, it would take me an hour before I would even start to fall asleep, and I would wake up two or three times through the night. Right? But I didn't know that there was another way to live than that. Like, I thought that was normal. Like, I thought that it was just about getting away from the drink and the drug. And once I was away from the drink and the drug, all these things would start to happen. And every new thing that I got, I was waiting for it to save me. Like, kind of like fulfill me, you know? And, so I went through the next 10 or 11 years kind of in that fashion. I bought a house. She got a promotion. I got a promotion. We bought a bigger house. I got another promotion. She got a promotion. I wasn't drinking. Never even came into my mind. I never even thought about drinking. It never popped into my head ever. I thought that drinking thing was away. I thought I was done. I thought I was never going to touch it again. It never even came up. So that was 24 until 35, and our relationship was deteriorating. You know, she was talking about wanting to get a divorce, and I was, of course, objecting to it. Because usually there's one person who wants to split up, and the other person doesn't want to. I was the doesn't want to one. You know what I mean? Like, she was my sweetheart from high school, and I did not want this thing to fall apart, but it was falling apart. It was slowly at first, and then at the very end, really, really rapidly. I don't really have a lot to say about that time period, except for a couple of things. I stopped going to meetings about 5 years sober. I was highly involved in meetings, and then I started working, I started getting busy with life, and then I just started to fall back. I was an intergroup rep. I used to take tons of commitments. So that started happening. I started getting really busy with life. Our relationship was deteriorating. I was really kind of like, the one thing that was about that I remember distinctly was I was really, really discontented with life. I remember that whole time period always thinking, like, there's got to be something more. There's got to be something more. And the rift and the space that it opened up between her and I guess everyone's probably been in a relationship that hasn't worked. But sometimes you realize that there's a space in between you and you can't get back to where you were. Like, you don't know how to get back to where you were connected, you know. And that was going on for me for a long time, so that had me completely screwed up. And then when I was 35, like, we didn't really talk about having kids. And then all of a sudden, it seemed like it was all of a sudden she wanted to get a divorce. And I lost it, dude. Like, I had 11 years sober and I was as unspiritually fit as I've ever been in my entire life. I had a panic attack and I never had a panic attack before. So I didn't know what it was. So I thought I was having a heart attack. I was at work and I was running down the hall like, I'm going to die. I like the suit and tie. I'm like ripping it off, you know? So they sent me to the hospital, and it was the first time I ever had a panic attack, and it gave me Ativan, and it was like it completely tripped me out. In fact, the Ativan calmed me down, and they took me into like this little small room, and they did a psych evaluation, and the guy was like, "Do you ever feel like you're stuck into a small room?" And I'm like, "Yeah, I do, dude. Like, that's where I'm at right now." He's like, "Do you feel?" And then it started the panic attack like all over again. Like, then I started to have the panic attack again. And I'm like, what are you doing, dude? Like, I was totally cool. And I didn't know a lot about benzos that point either, because I wasn't drinking or drugging, so I wasn't really paying attention to that type of stuff. But what that set off was panic disorder. So now I was living, she was gone. She had left because she had moved back to France. And I was living in panic disorder. And I was holding on to my sobriety if it would kill me. I would not take any medication. I refused all medication. I didn't know what Ativan was. And I was literally having a nervous breakdown. at 11 years sober. And then I was placed into a mental institution, and I still refused to have medication. They wound up releasing me. I wasn't well, but they wound up letting me go because my insurance was running out. And then I wound up back in there because I had a deeper nervous breakdown. So I'm an 11 year sober, more than I've ever been in my entire life, or right around the same time. I'm as completely as unspiritually fit as I've ever been. I'm completely insane. And I drove to Kentucky because I had in my mind that she had left me for a guy in Kentucky. She did wind up going with a guy in Kentucky, but I had in my, the story in my head was that she had left me for this guy, and that was the dissolution of my marriage. So I drove to Kentucky, and that turned out to be an absolute nightmare. I was just really, really sick. Like, I was a really sick person, sober, like really sick. And I couldn't see it. I didn't think I was sick. I thought, like, they were nuts. Like, they were doing this to me. You know what I mean? I was very, very delusional. And not delusional in the sense, like, I think that, like, the sky's red. I was just delusional in my thoughts and these lies that I tell myself, these stories. The first time I'd ever heard about the story in my head was when my sponsor sat me down and was taking me through the first step. And he just talked about stories in my head. And I know exactly what he's talking about now. I was stuck in these stories, right? These stories are really real. They're called a resentment. The stories are really real. So I came out of that, and you know what happened after that? I drank. Right? Because nothing else was working. So I drank. And I thought, when I took the first drink, I thought to myself, it's going to be about, I knew it was going to get bad. But I think it's going to be about a year. A year into it, I'll be cool. I'll go back to AA. I'll figure it out. I'll get sober. A year or two after that, I'll be good. You know what I mean? And that's not what happened with me at all. I took the first drink, and I was down the shore with a bunch of people, and I wound up being the last person all night drinking. Everyone else went to bed, and I was the last person drinking. And it wasn't because I could drink the most, because I couldn't, because I didn't drink in 11 years. It was because I couldn't stop. And I remember distinctly thinking, like, what are you guys doing? Like, you're going to bed? You know what I mean? Like, it's 4 a.m. Like, I'm ready to start partying. And it was like 5 days later, I was back buying drugs. It was about 35 to 45 days later, I lost my job of 11 years, right? It was about, I don't know, 3 months after that, my car was repoed. I mean, it's just like everything just started to fall. It was like once I picked up that first drink, I could not stop. I would go back into AA. I would get sober for 3 days. And I would swear to God, I'm never going to drink again. And somehow, 5 days later, I would wind up with a drink in my hand. And that thing played out in that exact manner for the next 10 years. I had like a 10 or 11 year relapse. There's stops along the way, right? So, I mean, if you have anybody that has relapses, for anybody that's relapsed, you know about the stops. You hit a bottom and you think, I'm done. You can kind of see the next bottom. You're like, I'm not going there. And you hit that bottom, you think I'm done. And then there's another one, and then there's another one, and another one. And mine were all like, you know, it was the car, it was the job, it was the 401k. It was like not showing up at family stuff. I remember one time, my mom, when I drink, I don't know about anybody else, but when I drink, I abandon everybody. Like, I abandon my family. Like, I'm gone. Like, I'm out the door. You know what I mean? In fact, I'd like completely hide from them. I make sure they don't know where I'm at. There's nowhere that they can find me, and I'm out. Like, I have this crazy guilty conscience about it, and I drink that away. I just use more to kind of like, to push that down. And I remember one time my mom, and I was baffled a lot. Like, I really couldn't figure out why I couldn't stay sober. I honest to God, like, I knew I was an alcoholic, and I kept going back to AA, and I just would keep drinking. Like, I felt like when you read the how it works, like the person is constitutionally incapable of being honest. Like, I thought that was me. Like, I was that dude that for whatever reason, this was not going to work for her. You know what I mean? Even though I had had time before. And I remember one time my mom begged me. I'd just gotten a job again. I was always losing jobs. And then it would seem like I would get paid. And then that pay, like, when I thought at one point I couldn't have any money. I was like, I'll never be able to have money in my entire life. Because every time I get money in my pocket, I go drink, like literally every single time. So I remember one night my mom, they were having like a little family thing, and my mom begged me. She was like, please don't drink tomorrow. I'm going to grab my little nephew, Shawnee, and she's like, I'm going to get Shawnee, and we're going to go see the family. And whatever you do, please don't drink. And I was like, I will not drink. I swear to God, I will not drink. And I meant it. Like, I meant it with like every cell in me. And I remember that night, man. I remember I had just kind of gotten sober again, and I was painting my dining room, and I was painting my dining room, and the next morning my mom showed up. And when she showed up, I was drinking vodka. It was like 10 o'clock in the morning. And I remember that night, like trying to go, I remember I was painting, and the thought came in, and it was just like, just a couple of beers won't hurt. I remember that. Like, I remember that happening. And I don't remember fighting. I don't remember saying, like, no, don't do this, anything like that. And the next day, the paint roller was, like, actually in the pan, and the pan was dry. Like, it happened that quick. Like, it was like the thought came in, and I was out the door. And I remember that night, I remember trying to go to sleep, like, to try to just get to sleep somehow, and taking whatever I could take to get to sleep. And I couldn't. Every time I laid down, I had to get up and go drink. I would put the vodka down and drink downstairs. And that whole night was like that. It was torturous. And when she saw me the next day, I was already crying because I was like, I just felt so bad. Like, I didn't want to drink. I really didn't. Like, that wasn't what the plan was. And I remember she said, why do you keep doing this to yourself? And it was like, it says in the book, it was like the first time I was honest. And I was like, I don't know. And I honestly, at that point in my life, had no idea why I drank. Why I kept doing this thing over and over and over. And that played out for another 5 years, that exact manner. Exact same manner. Get a job, get a paycheck, fight it. The thought will come in, I would drink. And that thing went just happening over and over and over. And so I lost everything. I was homeless, but I wasn't like homeless. Like, I'd stay on, you know, Mike's couch, or I'd stay on your couch, or I'd go to my grandma's, but I'd sleep in the car once in a while. I remember when it was cold out, I would go into Nazareth Hospital in the emergency room and try to like eke out 5 or 6 hours in there, or I'd stay under a bridge or something. But I wasn't like completely homeless for like weeks at a time or anything like that. But I lost everything. I mean, I just had a gym bag to my name. And then my buddy asked me to watch his house, and I lost everything. Everything was gone. I had a gym bag. I had a piece of crap car, and he was in Ireland, and I drank his whole liquor cabinet, and I spent all the money I had, and I was sitting there. There was a bottle of rum, and it was me and this bottle of rum, and I was 44 years old. And I can remember sitting there, and I was thinking, like, I just remember sitting there, and I remember looking at the rum, and I remember thinking, like, my entire life, everything about my entire life is coming right now to this bottle of rum. That's it. 44 years, and the only thing that matters is this bottle. And I hate rum. I do. I can't stand it. It's like cat piss. I cannot stand rum. Like, I'll drink kerosene. I will drink anything cocaine rum, but I cannot stand rum. And so I was sitting there looking at that rum, and I was just like, I'm done. I'm not doing this again. I made that decision again, one more time. And he came home the next day. I picked him up, drove him back, said, I'm out of here. I drove up to my dad's, who had like, he had a bunch of time at that point, and he was in New Hope. And I just showed up with a gym bag and just said, I need help. Can I stay here? I'm going to try and get sober again. And the next morning, I went to a meeting called Fog Lifters, 7 a.m. meeting. That meeting might have saved my life, because it was 7 a.m. every day, because I was really, really sick when I put down a drink. I mean, like, I didn't realize how sick I was. I was thinking about killing myself. There were a couple people that I had resentments with that I was thinking about doing something to them. And every morning I will wake up, and I will wake up crazy. I wake up in these deep, deep resentments, and I could go to that meeting. It would give me just enough of a break, right? Just enough of like a little gap. And so I was kind of felt like I was back, you know, like I went back to Holy Family. I was going to be a therapist. I was going to do all that kind of stuff. I got a job again. I started working out. You guys know, you start working out, looking good in the mirror, went back to the Y, all that kind of stuff. Got a job again. And like 9 months in, I was totally burnt out. I did like a 120, 120, 90, 90, nothing. I'm going to kill that. I do a 120, 120, you know, went to meetings, I got a sponsor. It had like, I didn't know it when I got it, but he had like 42 years sobriety. I was like, my dad had 30 years. My sponsor had 42. My best friend in the program, Kevin, Fish, he had like 26 years. I was like in the middle of like Michael Jordan, Dr. J of like sobriety. And I wound up drinking again, like 7 months later. When I drank again, I was down on the boulevard, and I called up a guy, Jay Utes. I don't know if anyone knows him, but he's from up here. He's an interventionist, and he came and got me and took me down to rehab. And when I was going into rehab, like I was like, I swear to God, I would do anything to have the obsession removed. Like, just please, please fix me. Somehow fix me, you know? And when I got into rehab, like 3 days later, I was ready to go. I was ready to walk out. Like, it takes about 2 or 3 days for my ego to rebuild and say, I got this. I know exactly how to get sober again, you know? And on that third day, I was getting ready to walk out, and they had the therapist talk to me, and she said, look at you, you're obsessing, you're going to drink again. And for some reason, I heard it. I knew it. Like, I knew it clearly. And it was Labor Day weekend, and that was a Friday, and I had this, like, whole thing, you know, I had this whole thing drawn out that I was going to do. I was going to go to all the AA gatherings and dances and do all. I hate dancing, dude. I've never, ever danced in my entire life. I would never go to AA dance. Not that there's anything wrong with it. It's just I feel weird in those places, you know. So anyway, so it hit me that, like, I was in the safest place in the world for an alcoholic, and yet I was still going to go drink. I was going to walk out of that place and go drink. And I kind of felt a fear that I hadn't felt before, and I went back to my room, and I had done this before. I don't know what, if anything was different or not. But I cried, and I got on my knees, and I just said, God, please help me, because nothing's going to work. And it was weird, because I was in an obsession, and I didn't ask for the obsession to be removed, but I kind of knew what happened. I kind of surrendered, and I knew that, I knew that I aligned my will with God's will in some way. And that whole process that happened, I knew I couldn't do again, too, by the way. I knew there was, like, no way I could possibly do that. And so I came out of that. So that Friday night, the same night, some guy was doing a big book study that night. He came in. He had 11 years sober, and he was completely at peace. And so when I had 11 years sober, I was in a mental institution. He had 11 years sober. He was completely at peace. And so I started to listen, right? And the guy was in the big book, and he was talking about the first step. And when I came out of there, I just started going to meetings saying, like, I need, can somebody please help me that knows the big book? I need somebody to take me through the steps, right? Because we had gone through the steps a long, I had gone through the steps a long time ago in the 12 and 12, and we did it differently, and it was, I mean, like, our fourth step was like me just kind of like complaining about everything, right? And my sponsor's going, like, good job, like, pat me on the butt. And so I came out of the rehab, and, I mean, I came out of there, and I started looking for somebody. I met up with this guy, Ben, and God changed my life, because I was getting ready to drink again, and I knew it. You know, if you're a chronic relapser, you know when it's coming, like, you know it's on its way, and there's nothing you can do to stop it. You're kind of just, like, whistling in the dark, like it says in the book. And we started meeting on a Friday night. It was me and three other guys. One guy was a principal. I think he was a principal who was stealing his dog's morphine. His dog was dying of cancer, and he was stealing his dog's morphine. The other guy had, like, half of his leg. He had just came out of a relapse and had, like, half of his leg taken off because he overdosed. And another guy had tried to kill himself. He relapsed on pot, and he tried to kill himself in a car. And then you had me. We were like the ragtag bunch. It was like the craziest thing. So Ben would show up at my place every Friday night. We would start going through the book. Now, I knew that there was a big book, and I'd read it a bunch of times. And I like what Claire says. Claire says, I didn't know there was a doctor, and I had no idea he had opinion. And that was my thing too. Like, I remember somebody saying, like, say it's the third step prayer. Like, I had no idea there was a third step prayer. Dude, I've been in or out of AA or around AA for over 30 years, and I had no idea there was a third step prayer. Never heard of it. Never even came up. I didn't know the steps were in the book. I thought it was just all stories. So we started going through the steps, and immediately, like, something started to happen with me. I started to connect to this book. And they say, like, the root of alcoholism, or the root of my alcoholism, I've come to find is a deep sense of separation from God and from myself and from other people. And that's why I was talking about the sense of separation earlier, that I lived in. And from the very beginning, like, something started happening. Like, I had in my head that I was not an alcoholic, or I was an alcoholic to the degree that wasn't going to be fixed. But that's not what I was. What I was an actual alcoholic. And we started going through the steps. And as we went through it, like, something started to happen. Like, I started to come alive inside. I started to feel really connected to my sponsor. What he was talking about was where I was at. I started feeling connected to the book. And then I started having experiences with the steps. And the first spiritual experience that I had was with step four. And that was when I was talking about earlier, when my wife had left me for a guy in Kentucky. When I was writing on my fourth step, when we turn it over and we do the fourth column, it starts to turn the light on ourselves. And I saw clearly, they say the truth will set you free. I saw clearly, very clearly, that she did not leave me for some guy in Kentucky. In fact, she stayed on about 8 years too long. That's what I saw. And I owed her an amends for stealing her time. And I literally, now I was in a bad, bad resentment for about 10 years. I mean, I was crying all the time. Like, I was a mess. And I literally dropped my pencil and laughed. I was like, oh my God, it was me the entire time. And that was only because I saw through the delusion of the resentment. I saw through the story in my head. And that was my first spiritual awakening, which really, if you listen to it, doesn't really sound all that spiritual, does it? No, but we know what happened when that happened. I felt a sense of peace. Like this really deep calmness and stillness. I went outside and I smoked 2 cigarettes. And I came back in and kept writing. And that was kind of how I was tackling the steps, right? Like I wasn't stopping. I wasn't doing like a step here to here. I wasn't doing any of that. Like not one time ever did my sponsor ask me to do something. He never had to ask me to do anything twice. Not once did he have to ask me to do anything twice. Every single time I was done ahead of time. And so I kept writing and I kept doing exactly what he said. And so that was my first experience in the 4th step. And then we got to the 5th. I did my 5th with him. 6th. The scariest part of all the steps for me was the 7th step. Because I had recognized by that point I was the big character defect. Seriously. Like I was sitting there in front of my coffee table and you're going to turn yourself over to God. Humbly asking for shortcomings, which means like giving yourself up. And that actually scared me because I didn't know it was going to be on the side of that prayer. And then we did our list. And when we had started at the beginning of the list, my wife was on the do not. I remember I was at a therapist too, Rich Brown. He's actually up here. I was doing therapy at the same time. I remember telling him I would never, ever, ever make amends to her, ever. And by the time we got to the 8th step, she was on that list. She was on the list. And so was everybody else. There wasn't one person I wouldn't make amends to. And I started having an experience in the 9th step. Like these things started happening where I started to trust in this higher power, this power greater than myself, whatever you want to call it. And things just started to happen. Like, I don't know how to explain it other than I started to feel really connected to this thing that we call God. And my conception of God had completely changed because I'm Irish Catholic. And I still consider myself to be a Catholic, but my experience with that whole thing completely changed. And I remember I was down in Oxford Circle like about 15 years ago. And I crashed my car into a bunch of other cars and I had a warrant out for my arrest and I had drugs on me and I had open containers all over my car and I ran. I left my car there and I ran. And I woke up about 1.5 years ago or 2 years ago. And for whatever reason, I knew that was the day I was going to make that amend. Right. I just knew it. And I sat on my chair, on my meditation chair, and I just prayed and I just said, all right, God, like I know today's the day. I'm going to go down and see if I can find this house. Start knocking on doors, and you lead and not follow. I'm not going to question it. Sunday morning, 9 a.m., I drive down to Oxford Circle. It's 10 o'clock when I get there. I'm driving around. I recognize the corner. I stop my car. I'm looking at these row homes, and I'm thinking, what do I do? I was like literally sitting there, like, what do I do? And I walked up, and I was looking at these row homes, and a guy walked around a corner, and he had a cup of coffee, and he stopped, and he looked at me. He said, can I help you? And I said, is this one of your houses? And he said, that's my house right there. And I said, this is going to sound really crazy. he said, what do you mean? I said, well, about 15 years ago, I crashed my car on this corner and took out like 2 or 3 cars. I said, and I'm an Alcoholics Anonymous and we repair the damage we've done in the past. And I'm just curious if you would happen to know any of the people that live in these houses. And he said, well, that's my house there. And I said, how long have they been here? And he said, I don't know, 30 years. So I was in the right place. And he said, when was this? And I said, around this time. And he said, my car was hit about 12 years ago. It was 12 years, actually. He said, my car was hit about 12 years ago. Now, I wasn't falling for it, right? I wasn't like, all right, here's 10 grand. It wasn't nothing like that. Trust me. I trusted in God, but it wasn't that far ahead. But I did say to him, he goes, my car was hit, but my car didn't get hit there. My car got hit back there. And then it hit me. I remember it clearly. I remember the entire thing now. And he's right. It wasn't up there. It was back there. And it was only one car. And I was standing there, and I swear to God, everything stood up in me, man. Everything. Like, my neck, my arms, everything was like, whoa. And then he, like, took a step back, and he's like, dude, I don't know what's going on here. But some kind of crazy stuff is going on here, and I don't want nothing. And I was like, dude, you don't understand. Like, I got to pay you back. And like we stood there and had a conversation. He couldn't believe it, right? And I went to the ATM, and we talked for a minute, and I said, how much was it, and how long ago, what kind of car, and blah, blah, blah. And I went, and I took out as much money as I could, and I gave it to him. And I said, I'll be back next week with the rest. And he's like, you ain't coming back. I said, I'll be back next week with the rest. And that next Saturday, I came back with the rest of the money. And when I was walking up, he came out. He said, stop. I said, what? I said, what's up? He's like, I don't want your money. He goes, I don't want it. He goes, you're out here doing all this good. You got me out here doing good now. And there's no amount of money that can pay for that. And I was like, holy shit, dude. Like, are you kidding me? Like, I just woke up like a week ago on a Sunday out of nowhere and just knew this amendment was, and that's happened to me like four or five times in amends. Crazy stuff. I want them giving them the money. I want them making them take it. I can't walk away with it, you know? I can't explain that. Like, I can't, there's no way, it goes past the alcohol. Like, there's no way to say, like, how that happens. It was 6 months before that, I was doing another amend. And I had written a guy in high school that I used to break into his house, his dad's house, because he was my age. And I broke into his house. And the night before, he's having problems with drugs and alcohol. His wife said, you got anybody that could possibly help you? He said, and he mentioned my name. The next day, he had a letter in his mailbox for me trying to make amends to him. And he thought it was a lie. He said he was shaking. He's like, dude, when I talked to him, he said, dude, I haven't talked about you in 25 years. I mentioned you last night to my wife. And today, I'm holding a letter from you asking to call me. Like, that's the kind of stuff that happens in my sobriety when I surrender and I start working with this thing called God or whatever term you want to call it, you know? So that was like, as a 9th step experience. And then 10th step, we got into 10th step and I started to live in the present moment. The 4 things we look for in the 4th step, we look for in the 5th, in the 10th step. And I started to actually look for my reactions to life. And then I started living in this thing called now. Like here, right now. Like, I have years sober during that 11-year period where I don't remember the entire year. Years. And I was sober. And you know why? Because I was always up here, and I was never here. Like, right now, I can feel my feet on my ground. I know it sounds kind of silly, right? I can feel myself breathe. I heard Mike move a little bit. Like, I'm actually present. Right? That little bit of space, and that this thing's not running crazy over and over and over and over and over. And if it does start to do that, that's what I'm looking for anyway, in the 10 step. And then I have a process to go through that, and that's to get back to the present moment, to pray, to call somebody, and to help somebody. Right? And then we go to 11 step, and I started practicing more meditation. I'd already been meditating. We started to do a nighttime meditation in the daytime. But really, it's the same 4 things again. It's resentment, fear, judgment, self-centeredness, all that kind of stuff that I'm looking for. And so I started really practicing these steps, like really getting into them. I started to get this crazy amounts of peace. I would be driving into work and I would be crying because I would feel so graced that I was not in active addiction. And I mean it. Like, I would call Ben up and be like, dude, I'm crying. Like, dude, I don't know what's going on, but I don't even know what's going on. And I'd be crying and he would be on the other end of the thing laughing. Like, dude, he's like, I get exactly what you're talking about. You're talking about being in grace, you know? And then we got to the 12th step and, in the 12th step, the first 12th step work I did was in jail. It was in BCCF, and I wound up putting together a program and taking step work in there. And I don't say it like that at all. I just mean like I was willing to do step. I was willing to put myself on the firing line. Whatever he asked me to do, I stepped out and I did it. I didn't care. Like, I was not going back. It wasn't happening. Not since I started to find this freedom. And then it says, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we try to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. I can make this really, really simple for my message is take the steps, practice the steps, and teach the steps. Like, that's pretty much my message, right? When I got to the 12th step, I started to have a different experience, another type of the spiritual awakening that has happened and continues to happen all the time. And that's when there's another alcoholic sitting on the other side of my coffee table and something starts to flow through me. And I don't know if they can feel it. I can feel it. It's a really profound amount of peace and connection. And it's almost like it's not me. Right? And so what is it? Like, what is that thing that we're talking about? And to me, what we're talking about is God. Right? Like, what is this thing we call God? Like, what's the connection? And I can't explain it. Like, I don't know how to convey... Like, if you just look outside and you just look at all the forms of life, right? I remember a long time ago, like, when being in AA, and I remember, like, people would say, like, God, nature's my God. And I'd be like, oh my God, it's like the craziest thing I've ever heard of. I know what they're talking about now. I know what they're talking about being connected to some type of a force or presence. Maybe that's the right term, presence. And to practice these principles in all our affairs. The most important thing that I can do today is to be of service to an alcoholic, providing that I'm in fit spiritual condition. And so the number one thing that I always do is try to attend to myself first, make sure that I am in fit spiritual condition. And if I am in fit spiritual condition, then I can start working with other alcoholics. And I go to a lot of sordid places that before I was afraid to go to in sobriety because I didn't want to get triggered. If anyone knows what that is. Because I used to get triggered a lot. I mean, a lot. Like, when I had, like, 2 weeks sober or 10 days sober or 9 days or 2-3 weeks, like, I was afraid to drive past Academy Road. I would call my buddy up, Steve, and I'd be like, dude, I'm driving past Academy. Call me in 15 minutes. Make sure that I get past it and I don't stop. Or I'm going past Cottman Avenue. Make sure I don't pull over and I don't go do something stupid. And he would call me back and be like, I made it. You know what I mean? Like, that used to happen to me all the time. It doesn't happen to me anymore because I'm in fit spiritual condition. I lead a pretty simple, blessed, and contented life. One that I never ever thought that I was going to get out of sobriety or out of being sober, especially out of the steps or any of this AA stuff. I thought the whole purpose of this was just to get away from the alcohol and the drugs, you know. So I'm incredibly blessed. Thank you for letting me come tonight and speak. We're a little bit early, but that's okay because we get to go home a little bit early tonight. So that's all I got. Thank you.